Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to MitoAction's monthly expert series. Today, Dr. Shana McCormick, Scientific Director of Children's Hospital of Philadelphia Neuroendocrine Center, and Dr. Herodes Guzman, a fourth-year combined fellow in clinical genetics, medical biochemical genetics, and pediatric endocrinology at CHOP, are joining us to discuss managing the highs and lows of mitochondrial disease, a review and updates on diabetes and hypoglycemia. My name is Stephanie Harry. I'm one of the patient support coordinators at MitoAction and will be your host for today. Today's presentation will be recorded and available on MitoAction's website in the coming days, as well as in our podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. We encourage you to ask questions throughout the presentation using the Q&A feature button on the bottom of your screen. If you're calling in via phone, feel free to submit your questions to us by email at info@mitoaction.org. We will do our best to get through all of the questions today. For many of those with mitochondrial disease, high and low blood sugars are all too common. Today, Dr. McCormick and Dr. Guzman will review and discuss the causes of high and low blood sugars in mitochondrial disease, while also providing important updates on mitochondrial diabetes and hypoglycemia management. Dr. McCormick is an attending physician in the Division of Endocrinology and Diabetes and an assistant professor of pediatrics at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. She cares for children with pediatric and endocrine disease, and she has a clinical interest in patients with endocrine dysfunction related to individually rare metabolic disorders such as primary mitochondrial disease, Friedreich ataxia, and lipodystrophy. She also has an interest in inherited and acquired forms of hypothalamic and pituitary dysfunction, in particular those associated with abnormal energy balance and obesity. As a physician scientist, she investigates the neuroendocrine systems that regulate energy balance in humans. Dr. Guzman completed medical school at the UNC School of Medicine and pediatric residency at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Currently, he's a fourth-year combined fellow in clinical genetics, biochemical genetics, and pediatric endocrinology at CHOP. His interests include treating endocrinopathies within rare disease, specifically disorders affecting glucose homeostasis. He's working with Dr. Rebecca Ganetsky and Dr. McCormick to better characterize the natural history of mitochondrial diabetes, which may have broader implications for patients with more common forms of diabetes. His plan is to continue leading clinical research that helps advance the care he provides to his patients with both common and rare metabolic disorders. So today's presentation, Dr. Guzman, is primarily going to be running, and we are super, super excited because Dr. Guzman mentioned this has been on his mind. He's been inundated and saturated with this information, and he's very, very excited to share with you guys today all that he has been learning. His dual fellowships is a true amazing and exciting thing for our community. So we're so excited to have him here today to share. And Dr. McCormick will be here today to support him. So thank you so much, Dr. Guzman, for joining us. And we are so excited to get started.
Stephanie and everyone, thank you so much. I'm really excited to be here. I'm going to go ahead and share my screen just so that we make sure that you guys can see it. Can everyone see that, Stephanie? Yep. Okay, perfect. So just to give a brief introduction to why this is important to me and to the endocrine community. As Stephanie so lovely introduced me and Dr. McCormick, we are both very much interested in how the endocrine system affects our patients with rare disease. And I really want to just preface by saying everything we talk about today and everything I am discussing is very much still something we're learning a lot about. And at the end of the day, this is a team effort between us as your doctors and your healthcare team, and you all as the patients and the experts of your body. And really, I have learned so much through my combined training just from talking to many patients with mito conditions. And so my hope is that you guys will understand why diabetes and low blood sugars and mito disease is so important, and why I'm dedicating a lot of my time and my career to this among this community. And so to get things started, I don't think it's comes as a surprise that in mitochondrial illness, a lot of organ systems are affected. And I think the picture to the right of the screen highlights this. But in particular, endocrine organs can be affected. And the way that they're affected is often from deficiency. So something happens that doesn't allow us to produce a sufficient amount of our body's own hormones, which can lead to disease. And in general, the most common endocrine issue that our mito patients face is mitochondrial diabetes. And I know some of you all may be asking, what about growth? Growth is something that is very commonly affected in our mito community. And it's important to state that there are definitely endocrine-related issues that lead to growth concerns, but there are so many different things that can cause growth issues that oftentimes we have to do a broader workup and think about growth issues in mitochondrial disease beyond the endocrine system. And so today's focus is really going to be on blood sugars. And the reason that we focus on blood sugars is because it's a very common reason that causes our mito patients to go into health crises. For example, in one paper, there was a group in Texas that were looking at their community of mito patients. And when we look at all of their mito patients together, what we see is that 7% of the reasons these patients went to the hospital were because of endocrine disease. And in all of those endocrine issues, all of them were blood sugar related, whether that was high blood sugar or low blood sugar. And because we know mitochondrial disease is very complex and varies patient to patient, they broke that down between those patients who have mito DNA issues and nuclear DNA issues. And what we tend to see is that a lot of our patients with mito diabetes end up having mito DNA issues that lead to their mitochondrial disease. And when this study looked into their patients with mtDNA differences, the hospital admissions were caused by endocrine issues 18% of the time. And so, because of how common it is for our mito patients to present to the hospital with blood sugar issues, we're going to focus first on mito diabetes and then follow that up with low blood sugars or hypoglycemia. Okay, so mito diabetes. Mito diabetes affects around 2% of children with mitochondrial disease and 24% of adults with mitochondrial disease. And I really want to note here that on the information that I'm presenting today is based off of a lot of work and effort from our researchers looking into the mito community, but there's still so much to learn. And so a lot of the numbers you're seeing today are estimates of what we think we're seeing in our mito patients. So I present here on the right a table breaking down our mito patients by gene variation or gene differences. And how common mito diabetes is in that group. But overall, when we look at all mito patients, around 15% of mito patients end up having mitochondrial diabetes, which is a large amount of our patients and why we care so much about keeping an eye on blood sugars in clinic. And so now, an important concept that I think is gonna come up a lot during this conversation is blood sugars and why they matter to our body. So an important concept, I'm going to write this down because I just like doodling, I guess, but our body needs energy to function, and our body has three big groups or sources of energy that it uses to continue functioning. One of them being blood sugar, which is our body's favorite source of energy, which I've labeled here as S. And then after that comes fat. And so when our body isn't seeing enough sugar, it's going to go to another source of energy. And so it goes to fat to make sure our body continues working. And then finally, the other big source of energy is protein. And protein isn't a common or favorite source of energy for our body to use because it's very hard to access and isn't quick enough to keep our body safe. And so we present this chart here as a way to show you to show you the difference between what a safe range of blood sugar is or what our blood sugar goals are for patients with mito disease or chronic illness versus that of a patient without mito disease or chronic illness. And what I really want you to take away from this is that it's important to keep a really close balance on our blood sugars on a day-to-day basis. And that safe range gets narrower for our patients with chronic disease. And so if we ever detect a low blood sugar or a high blood sugar, when we're taking care of our patients, it's important to work that up. And so we're going to go through how we keep an eye on blood sugars in our mito patients. So we start off by educating our patients on what are the symptoms of diabetes. It's important to note that
Dr. Guzin, you froze. Can you hear me?
a lot like other symptoms that
Dr. Guzman, excuse me, can you hear me?
yes.
Okay, you froze for about 10 seconds.
Okay.
So maybe if you can start this slide over, that might be really helpful.
Okay, perfect. Will do. So when we're thinking about looking out for symptoms of mito diabetes, it's important to note that some of these symptoms can be very similar to other symptoms that are caused by mitochondrial disease. So I present here general symptoms of diabetes, but it might be that other patients present with different symptoms. And so when we are talking with patients and educating them on symptoms of diabetes, we say if there's ever any concern or there's any doubt, just check a blood sugar to make sure. And so general symptoms of diabetes development, we classify as polys. So when I say polys, I mean polyuria or increased urination, polydipsia or increased thirst, and polyphagia. Sometimes people have increased hunger because they're really seeking that energy that they're not seeing. And in diabetes, what ends up happening is that our body doesn't have enough insulin to allow our blood sugar to be used as energy. And insulin really acts as a key to our body's cells to allow our body to take the sugar we're eating and seeing and make it into energy. And so if that ends up happening, what we end up doing is losing weight and then having other sorts of symptoms like fatigue come about. And at its most severe, what ends up happening are emergency situations in which we can develop something called diabetic ketoacidosis or hyperosmolar hyperglycemia. And so diabetic ketoacidosis results when our body is not seeing the sugar we need for energy. And so it turns into using fats for energy. And then fats are broken down into something called ketones, which I'll get into a lot during this talk. When our body makes ketones, it makes the blood acid level lower, or it makes it higher. And that can make us feel sick. And so what we end up experiencing is nausea, vomiting, belly pain, confusion. And as it gets more and more severe, you can also ex go into coma and be unresponsive. So it's super important to pay close attention to those types of symptoms. In situations where some patients still have or are producing their own insulin, there might be situations in which the blood sugar is really high and you're still losing a lot of water because you're peeing a lot. And you end up developing what's called hyperosmolar hyperglycemia. In those situations, the symptoms can be very similar and are equally as dangerous. So it's important to really try to keep these symptoms in mind when there's any concerns for a patient at risk for diabetes. Now, the complicated thing about mito diabetes is that it is different than the common forms of diabetes we think about. So the common forms of diabetes are type 1 and type 2 diabetes. In type 1 diabetes, our own body's immune system attacks our insulin-producing cells in the pancreas, leading to decreased to no insulin. And so what ends up happening is your blood sugar ends up going really high because they can't be used for energy by the body. In type 2 diabetes, this situation happens when the patient is still making insulin, but is needing to make more and more insulin because the body's less responsive to the insulin it's seeing. And similarly, we end up seeing issues with high blood sugars. And because the body is working overtime to try to keep blood sugars in check, eventually, even patients with type 2 diabetes have insulin deficiency because their pancreas gets tired out. What we see in mitodiabetes is something of a combination of both of these types of diabetes, which makes it difficult to manage. And so currently, we don't have any evidence-supported practices specific to mitodiabetes. And so we end up relying on standard guidelines that help us take care of patients with type 1 and type 2 diabetes. And so when we see a patient with mito disease in our clinic, we're often thinking, what are these patients at increased risk for? And so when we think about a risk for diabetes, what we tend to do is check what's called a hemoglobin A1C on a yearly basis, or if there's any symptoms of diabetes coming up. And a hemoglobin A1C is a blood test that we can take in clinic, which measures the average blood sugar level over 3 months. And that's the lifespan or how long a red blood cell lives. And the whole way a hemoglobin A1C works is that when our blood cells are floating around in our blood vessels, they end up running into sugar that is present. And when they encounter this sugar, what they end up, the sugar ends up sticking to the blood cells. So I'm just going to write this down and just see these little markers here are just blood sugar that this blood cell is encountering. And so what the hemoglobin A1C says is, are these blood cells, do they have a lot of sugar stuck on them or a quote unquote normal amount of blood sugar stuck on them? And we define a patient with diabetes as having greater than or equal to 6.5% hemoglobin A1C. And so they have a large enough amount of blood sugar, of sugar stuck to their blood cells that we're concerned for diabetes. Now, the problem is, and I'm sure some of you guys, know this from personal experience, not all labs are perfect, and the hemoglobin A1C depends on our blood count. And in mito disease, what we see often is anemia or low blood counts. And so, what we risk in using this test is we may miss patients with diabetes if we solely rely on hemoglobin A1C, because when there's low blood counts, it can artificially lower our hemoglobin A1C. And so thankfully, we have developed other lab methods for seeing how to measure blood sugar over time. Some of those include a lab called fructosamine, which is looking at protein, our body's proteins, and how much sugar is stuck to them. And then we also suggest in clinic that before coming to see us every time to check your blood sugars for at the very least 3 days prior to the visit to see what patterns we're seeing. And we tend to recommend checking first thing in the morning to get a fasting sample and then 2 hours after the largest meal of the day. And the reason we do this is because maybe your blood sugars are easier or your body's able to control blood sugars when it's not being challenged with food or extra sugar. And so we may not see the signs of diabetes if we just depend on a fasting sample. And so we end up also requesting a 2 hours after meal sample to see, oh, after my body's being challenged, is my body able to keep my blood sugars in check? And if we don't, or if we're starting to see high blood sugars after meals, it might be an early sign that we need to start thinking about a patient with diabetes. Now, when we identify someone with diabetes, we have multiple different therapies that we can use to help them control blood sugars and keep them healthy. How do we decide to use insulin versus oral medications? On the right, I show you how we come up with this decision. So if a patient's making ketones, like we had talked about before, it means that their body's not seeing sugar and is not seeing energy from sugar. And so it's breaking down fat into ketones to use it as energy. In that situation, we know we need to start insulin. And when the body's not seeing enough energy, it's also prone to losing weight. And then you can also become dehydrated from the high blood sugar itself. So in all of those scenarios, whether you have ketosis or dehydration or weight loss, we think starting insulin is the safest and best option for the patient we're seeing in front of us. If none of those symptoms are seen when we see a high blood sugar, though, we can talk about oral therapies with our patients. And so breaking this down a little bit further, when we think about insulin therapy, there's a lot of ways to deliver this hormone to our body to help control our blood sugars. What we usually recommend is starting with the basics. So the basics usually means multiple daily injections, and those injections can look different because of the types of insulins we're using. So the most common type of regimen we use is something called a basal bolus regimen. So to separate these two words out, basal means something in the background. And so our body always makes insulin throughout the entire day to keep our blood sugars in check, even when we're not eating. And then when we do eat, our body makes extra insulin to keep our blood sugar in check when we see extra blood sugar. That's a bolus. And so there are different types of insulins we can use now to help us try to mimic what our body would do if we still had insulin. And so when we're thinking about delivering this insulin, it can be in syringes, but it can also be in pens. And I show a little cartoon over here to kind of give you an idea of what this looks like. But the goal is the same. It's to try to replicate what our body would do if it was still making its own insulin. For our patients with mito disease who have alternative feeding regimens, like tube feeds, for example, you may see them on something called 70/30, which is just a different type of insulin that's mixed together to help cover blood sugars better. And again, the goal is always to try to keep blood sugars in that safe, normal range. Thankfully, over time, we've been able to start advancing the way we deliver insulin through technology. And so I also put a cartoon on the left showing an insulin pump system. And so in this cartoon here is the insulin pump itself, which stores the insulin that needs to be used and is usually enough to cover like 3 days worth of what a patient needs. And then it can be injected through this small catheter right underneath the skin into the fat to deliver the insulin that's needed. And the really good, nice thing about these pumps is that we can give much more exact doses and get better control of our blood sugars through these methods. Because technology can fail, we often say, depending on the situation, depending on our patients, we always have conversations about when is the best time to start technologies. But we always want to make sure that they are comfortable using syringes or pens in moments that technology fail, because they do. And so it's always a topic of conversation we can have in clinic. Now, moving on to oral medications. So, in those patients with mito diabetes who don't have insulin deficiency, a lot of the oral medications help us augment or improve the insulin our body is making, or make it more responsive. And so, walking down the list, some medications we can use include sulfonylureas. And what a common theme you'll see as I walk through these medications is that it's really patient dependent, and it's a conversation with the families and what mito symptoms they have, because no medication is without risk. And so when we think about sulfonylureas are oral medication that helps increase our body's own insulin secretion. And so there's always a risk for low blood sugars. And so in patients who have a propensity or are more at risk of having low blood sugars, it would be a much more careful balance and discussion about whether this might be a medication for them. Other medications that are on the market now are GLP-1 receptor agonists or combo drugs like tirzepatide. And you guys may be seeing these much and much more often as Ozempic or Mounjaro, Zepbound, et cetera, because they've gained a lot of traction for their weight loss effects, but they also help control blood sugars in our patients with diabetes. The thing to remember and consider when thinking about these drugs, however, is that they do partially work by slowing the gut's motility down. And so in our patients with mito disease who have gut dysmotility, it's important to weigh the benefits and risks of using this medication. In our patients with pancreatitis, it is also important to think about whether this would be the best drug to use because GLP-1 receptor agonists do increase the risk of pancreatitis. Another drug that can be considered is called metformin. This one's a very cheap and very accessible drug, but it does have a lactic acidosis risk. And so in our mito patients who experience or are prone to lactic acidosis, this is something we tend to avoid. However, at the bottom, there is a new drug under study called emegalimin. And emegalimin is similar to how metformin works. It works in two ways. One, it helps by decreasing the amount of sugar that's being released by our liver to control blood sugars. And it also helps our body respond to insulin better, too. And it seems like emegalimin seems to have less of a lactic acidosis risk, but it's such a new drug that we still are learning more and more about it. So it could be a potential therapy for our mito diabetes patients in the future. SGLT2 inhibitors are drugs that work by helping your body release sugar through your kidneys to keep your blood sugars in check. Unfortunately, the risk associated with these drugs is ketoacidosis, and that's with normal blood sugars too. And so, to kind of give you an understanding of why that is, if your kidneys are releasing sugar and your body is now seeing less blood sugar, your body may think, oh, I'm not seeing enough energy. So, I'm going to start using fat, and I'm going to start using fat as ketones. And so now you can put yourself at a risk of having ketoacidosis because the insulin your body is making is also decreased now because your blood sugars are normal. And so there have been reports of what's called euglycemic ketoacidosis when using SGLT2 inhibitors. So it's even more important if you and your provider decide to use SGLT2 inhibitors for your mito diabetes that you talk about what the signs and symptoms of ketoacidosis are. Finally, DPP-4 inhibitors are basically work similar to our GLP-1 receptor agonists, but they've only really been studied in adults. So for our pediatric folks, it's something we are not as accustomed to using. So now, what about blood sugar monitoring? So we're trying to keep our blood sugars in range. And the thing we tend to promote as our gold standard or what we want our patients to rely on are fingerstick blood sugars. Now, again, technology isn't perfect, but fingerstick blood sugars give you the exact blood sugar you have in the moment. And they'll allow you to monitor your blood sugars throughout the day, but they don't give you that data in between. And what we tend to recommend is pre-meal blood sugar checks and whenever you're having symptoms. And so that can be very burdensome for our patients with mito diabetes and with diabetes in general. And so thankfully, over time, we've also developed technologies to help with monitoring blood sugars, not only more closely, but less burdensome. And so I provide a picture here on the left of an example of a very common continuous glucose monitor. And so this device here is called a Dexcom continuous glucose monitor that goes on the skin, and a little sensor is inserted right underneath the skin into the fat to sense the sugar levels of the body via what's called interstitial fluid. And what ends up happening is that your phone can report what your blood sugars are every 5 minutes. So not only does it give you that blood sugar information much more throughout the day. It also gives you trends, and so you'll see this arrow here. This arrow is, in this example, is indicating the blood sugar is stable, and it's predicting that the blood sugar will continue to be in that range over the short future. But that arrow can go any which way direction to tell you, oh, the blood sugars are rising or the blood sugars are decreasing. And so it can help a patient avoid high or low blood sugars in that way. The important thing to note, however, is that because the sugar is being measured in an interstitial fluid, it is delayed by around 5 to 10 minutes over the finger stick blood sugar. So what we counsel our patients on is, not only can you see different numbers on your blood sugar meter, you can see these across devices too. So your Dexcom or your CGM, as we call them, might be seeing a different number than your finger stick blood sugar is showing. In those situations, especially when you think you're having a low or high blood sugar, we always say go for the finger stick blood sugar because it's giving you the number at that time. And for the question of, oh, when I check my finger stick blood sugar once and then try to confirm it immediately after, the blood sugar numbers are different. Is that okay? And so we tend to counsel our patients on is that none of our technology is perfect at exactly capturing where our blood sugar is. But in those situations, we can see variations or expect variations of around like 30 points. And so you may get a blood sugar reading like 95, and then when you repeat it, it's 102. That's close enough that we're saying your blood sugar is probably somewhere in between that. And to trust your finger stick blood sugar there, and that it's a normal blood sugar, and there's nothing to do at that time. Now, in situations where blood sugars are low, we'll talk about what to do there in a couple of slides. So, if your blood sugar is low in the setting of diabetes, it's often because you have too much insulin in your body. And that's hard because we're asking our patients to try to do the pancreas's job, and that can be tough to get right. And so in situations where we've given ourselves too much insulin, we have these medications, all different forms of glucagon, which is our counter-regulatory hormone or the hormone that acts against insulin to keep our blood sugars in check. And so when a patient is having a severe low blood sugar, they can take one of these medications pictured here to help bring up their blood sugar and act against the insulin overdose they have. When these situations, we often recommend going to the emergency room because glucagon only is really going to keep your blood sugar stable for around 30 minutes before the insulin that's still in your body may take effect again and lead to another low blood sugar. And so it's important to always have these on hand. We say, like, treat them like your EpiPen. You should always have one on hand in case of dicey situations. And so to summarize, in mito diabetes, we see that mitochondrial disease is associated with diabetes because insulin secretion requires mito ATP production. Insulin resistance can still be seen in mito diabetes, which makes it the management of mito diabetes more complicated. But importantly, we always educate our patients regarding symptoms of either high or low blood sugar, so they're best prepared to test the blood sugar to help with the diagnosis of diabetes. When we see our patients in clinic, we screen annually, and we have different ways of screening to make sure we don't miss an early case of diabetes. Because mito diabetes can be a combination of type 1 and type 2 diabetes symptoms, we manage based on the patient in front of us, and we select medications based on what other mito symptoms they have. And whenever possible, to try to relieve the burden that our mito patients are facing from diabetes, we try to use technology whenever possible. On the right, I'm just providing an example algorithm of how one may come about a diagnosis of mito diabetes. And I really just want to highlight two things quickly. One is mito diabetes is a thing of in and of itself, but it doesn't mean that patients with mitochondrial disease can't also have type 1 diabetes. because of an immune system problem. So it's important for us as doctors to be able to distinguish which of the two one may have, because that can definitely help guide our treatment of that patient. And then the other thing is that sometimes patients with mito disease, their first symptom is mito diabetes. And so in those situations, those patients can sometimes be misdiagnosed or misclassified as having type 1 or type 2 diabetes, when in fact they may have a mitochondrial illness. So in those situations, it's very important to have a high, what we call a high index of suspicion, by looking for other symptoms of mito disease that can help prompt genetic testing to help come to that kind of a diagnosis. So we've just talked a lot about high blood sugars. Now I'm going to switch over to low blood sugars. So low blood sugars are also really common in mito disease. In one study, the overall prevalence or proportion of patients with mito disease that have low blood sugar without diabetes, so not caused by the medications we're giving them, was 19%. So it's also a super important thing to keep in mind when we're seeing our mito patients. The symptoms of hypoglycemia, again, not specific to mito disease in particular, but in general, when someone's having a low blood sugar, they tend to be really hungry. They can have fast heart rates, be shaky or be trembling. They can start sweating and then eventually develop confusion, dizziness, have difficulty concentrating, and at its worst, have seizures and unresponsiveness. So it's super important to educate our patients about these symptoms. And so when evaluating a person who's found to have low blood sugars, we divide that into ketotic or non-ketotic hypoglycemia. Oftentimes when we see these patients and they have ketotic hypoglycemia, it's in the setting of not having ate for several hours. And that's because, again, that premise of our body using resources of energy. When someone's fasting, that means they probably run out of their fuel from sugar. And so now their body's turning to fat to make ketones to help their body keep running. On the opposite end, there are cases of non-ketotic hypoglycemia in our mito patients. That's often a result of reactive hypoglycemia. And when I say that, I usually mean that this situation can occur in our patients who are often tube-fed or on TPN. And so they have a constant source of sugar. And so their body's responding to the sugar. And so in turn, their body is making insulin to try to keep their blood sugar in check. And so if a team in the hospital or a family at home has a sudden event where that sugar access is stopped, like for example, the tube stops working or the IV line is disconnected, you can see low blood sugars because the body's not quick enough to readjust the high insulin circulating in the blood to the blood sugar that they are now seeing. And so you can see this non-ketotic hypoglycemia because insulin is not allowing your ketones to be used, because your body's saying, oh, I should have enough blood sugar. I don't need fat right now. And that can be a particularly dangerous situation that is easy to correct by giving sugar. Now, one thing to keep in mind, though, is that not everyone can make ketones super well, and that includes our patients with mito disease. And so I show this chart here as from a study from CHOP and Nemours Children's Hospital, who looked at our mito patients and compared them with a group of patients with ketotic hypoglycemia. So they're making ketones when they're having low blood sugars, but they don't have a mito defect themselves. And what we're seeing here is that, one, our mito patients can't fast for as long as a patient without mito disease, and they can't make ketones as well as a patient without mito disease. And so that can be put our patients with mito disease at risk, because then your body doesn't have any real source of energy to keep it going. And so this is why it's super important to keep low blood sugars in mind when we see our patients with hypoglycemia or with mito disease. And so what causes hypoglycemia in mito disease? So as you've probably gathered from what I've explained so far, hypoglycemia is inherent to mito disease. Our body makes energy from our blood sugar in our mitochondria. And so if we have dysfunctional mitochondria, we're going to have an issue with using our blood sugar and can have low blood sugars because of that. In mito disease, we can also see plenty of liver dysfunction, and that's where a lot of our blood sugar is processed. And so if our liver is damaged, we can also see low blood sugars for that reason. A lot of our patients with mito disease suffer from growth issues I had mentioned earlier. And so when there's malnutrition, there's not a lot of stores of sugar to use in moments of fasting. And so we can also see low blood sugars because of that. We talked about reactive hypoglycemia. And then finally, there are other endocrine issues that are associated with low blood sugars that we're going to talk about shortly, which is adrenal insufficiency and growth hormone deficiency. And then, as we've talked about a lot already, in diabetes management, it's important to know that an insulin overdose can lead to low blood sugar, as well as some of our oral medications. And so, what do you do in the moment of a low blood sugar? You give sugar. And so, in the emergency room or in the hospital, we push dextrose fluids at a high concentration to rescue a patient with low blood sugar in the moment. But it's so tricky because, again, our blood sugar is processed by our mitochondria. And when our mitochondria are not working well, if the sugar here cannot enter our mitochondria to be converted into energy or ATP, it's going to try to find a different way to be used. And that ends up being lactate. And so I'm going to label that as an L here. And so what ends up happening is if we're not careful about the amount of sugar we're giving to our mito patients, we can end up actually causing lactic acidosis. And so once we've rescued a patient from a hypoglycemic event, we use more normal concentrated dextrose fluids in the hospital until that patient can tolerate the regular feeding regimen. And so overall, when we have a hypoglycemic event, our goal is to avoid prolonged fasting and to try to start them on their typical feeding regimen as soon as possible, because we know our mito patients are so dependent on their nutrition sources to keep their mitochondria healthy that that is one of our top priorities. In certain situations where the blood sugar may be hard to control, we may even add insulin in there to help keep our blood sugars in that safe range, not too low and not too high. At the end of the day, though, what we end up doing is making a plan. And so there should always be an emergency plan and letter available to educate our doctors who aren't mito specialists on what to do in the situation of a low or high blood sugar. And so we provide each of our patients in clinic with that guidance to provide to the emergency room. Okay, so now from a day-to-day basis of low blood sugars, how do you keep yourselves in check at home? So we recommend checking blood sugars after the longest usual fasting period, and that's usually first thing in the morning, because you've been sleeping all night, you probably haven't had a meal since dinner, to make sure that your body's tolerating that fast. And then whenever you're symptomatic. So again, if you're ever in question, like a lot of the symptoms we're talking about are very vague, it's always safest to just check that blood sugar and make sure it's not because of that. Our goal is always to keep our blood sugars at least 70 points or higher. And it's important to know that an emergency is a blood sugar less than 50. Because our technology is not perfect, even though we say the finger stick blood sugar is like the gold standard correct way to check a blood sugar, we say repeat that blood sugar because it's really hard to measure something that's not there. And so when you have a blood sugar less than 70, if you're seeing like a 65 and then a 64, you can be pretty sure that you're having a low blood sugar. Treat yourself, give yourself that snack, and then reach out to your provider to see, is there anything that's causing this extra stress from my body, whether that be a virus, malnutrition, or something else. But say, for example, you get a blood sugar reading and it's 62, but then you check immediately again and it's an 80, it might just be something else going on. And it's still important to check in with your provider. But it's important to know that sometimes technology isn't super accurate in those cases. Along with our blood sugar meters, we send our patients home with blood ketone meters. And I show a picture here to help you understand why. So, again, a lot of our body's energy is processed through the mitochondria. And so, when the mitochondria is not working well, some of those processes don't work super well. And so when we measure ketones, we can measure it in the blood or we can measure it in the urine. And blood ketones is preferred by us because it gives you your ketones in the moment. It's an immediate measure of where your ketones are at. And the blood ketones that are being measured are called beta hydroxybutyrate, which is right here in this square. When it's being taken out into the urine, it's processed from the ketone called beta hydroxybutyrate to acetoacetate. And that's what urine ketones measure. So not only are urine ketones delayed by a couple of hours, so they don't tell you exactly where your ketones are in the moment, they can also actually be lower because of mitochondrial dysfunction. There's not good conversion between this type of ketone and this type of ketone. So we always say safest to check a blood ketone if you're concerned that you're having hypoglycemia and you tend to have ketotic hypoglycemia. Finally, watch out for MPO status. We know that a lot of our mito patients undergo procedures. And so if there's ever a requirement of not eating nothing by mouth, our patients should always have some source of sugar available to them or to avoid fasting them for too long. So having those surgeries set out first thing in the morning, procedures set out first thing in the morning to help avoid issues of fasting. Okay, and now our last portion of the talk is talking about other things we see in mito disease that can lead to low blood sugar. The first off being adrenal insufficiency. So again, mitochondria are super important for many of our organs, and that includes our adrenal glands, which make steroids. And our steroids help make our stress hormones. So here on the right, I show a little diagram. We all have this gland here called the pituitary gland that lives in our brain. And that is like our command center for telling a lot of our endocrine hormones to start working. And one of those is our stress hormone. And so what the pituitary gland does is it shoots out this signal, ACTH, to tell our adrenal glands, make that stress hormone called cortisol. And we do use that just as we use that in moments of stress, just like the name says. And so if there's any illness, whether that be a virus or something else, and our body isn't making enough cortisol or stress hormone, we can see symptoms of not only low blood sugar, but low blood pressure, low sodium levels, and high potassium levels. And this is particularly important to assess in our patients with mito disease because there are in the PICU setting, which I'm showing here, the rate of mortality can be higher in our mito patients when compared to patients with other diagnoses. And so you may see your provider sometimes use something called stress dose steroids in an effort to try to protect our mito patients who may actually end up having adrenal insufficiency from their mito disease. And so when do we test for adrenal insufficiency? In general, we test if a person has been exposed to steroid medications for other reasons. And that can make our adrenal glands get a little lazy or sleepy because now something else is making that steroid hormone. And so when patients come off of steroid medications, they're at risk for adrenal insufficiency. But in general, if we're having symptoms of adrenal insufficiency, like some of the ones I've talked about, it's always a good call to check for adrenal insufficiency, which is why we do so regularly in our endocrine clinic for mito patients. How do we screen? We can send various labs. We can send the signal that we're looking at, the ACTH. We can send the actual stress hormone level itself, cortisol. Or we can send these labs here, which are other steroid hormones that our adrenal glands make that help with fluid balance, as shown here in this picture. If we're seeing issues here, we end up moving to stimulation testing or provocative testing, which is basically us trying to mimic a stress response, like, oh, I'm going to give you this signal now. Let's see what your body can do. And if we find that someone has adrenal insufficiency, we help replace their steroid hormone with different medications. If it's not a, if there's somewhat of a response, like a patient has some stress hormone in their body, it may simply mean doing something called stress dose steroids, which is providing medications of steroid hormones only with illness. But again, it's super important to balance when to give patients medications, because there's always adverse effects when giving medicines, and too much of a thing can be bad. Okay, finally, growth hormone deficiency. So growth hormone deficiency can lead to low blood sugars, but often in babies and infants, and that usually tends to get better over time. But because growth hormone deficiency can lead to other issues with growth, for example, so like with height, it's important to screen in our patients with mito disease because they do have growth issues as a common feature. Now, that can be because of a host of other reasons that, like I had talked about, it's not all endocrine related, but in those situations where we're looking for an endocrine related issue with growth, we send labs called growth factors to look for that. And we can also do stimulation testing like we do in adrenal insufficiency to see if there indeed is growth hormone deficiency. If there is, we also have replacement for that hormone through injections, but it's important to weigh the benefits and risk, especially in our mito patients, because growth hormone, again, helps support your blood sugars. And so sometimes we are cautious with using growth hormone in mito patients because of their increased risk for diabetes. So to summarize, endocrine disorders are super common in our mito patients, and they can lead to things like mito diabetes and hypoglycemia, which can result in hospital visits or ED visits. And so that's why it's super important for your endocrinologist to be familiar with mito disease, and why we care so much about learning more about this and working with our patients with mito disease on these problems. Hopefully, with time, we'll get more evidence-supported guidelines for how to manage mito diabetes specifically, as well as hypoglycemia. But hopefully, you all see that our approach that we use at and in our own clinic and with our own patients can help unburden what a lot of our mito patients face. And with that, I will say thank you. Here are some resources, of course, that you can look at, but I want to save some time for questions.
Thank you so much, Dr. Guzman. Oh my goodness. My brain is just exploding with lots of new information. So I really, really appreciate you taking the time to do such a thorough presentation and breaking so much information down for us. Everyone that's on this call has been asking really great questions here in the chat. So we'll get to those. And also know that, if that this is recorded. So if you're like, oh, I missed that, you can absolutely go back and it should be posted sometime next week. The first question is in regards to Ozempic, and you did a great job at kind of breaking down how these different medications work and some of the complications. And you mentioned with the Ozempic that it works by slowing your gut down. And so I'm curious, what would be the implications? Like if you are already prone to pancreatitis or your gut is slowing down, like how would that, and you end up taking Ozempic, but you don't realize the other, like how does that typically present itself? And if there's anything else, because a patient asked, but she asked us before you talked about it. So they asked how it works. Like, are there other ways that it works other than slowing the gut down as well?
Yes. So, yeah, it can be really tricky. Ozempic and similar medications have really changed the landscape of our field for how to manage weight loss. But they've been initially they were studied for diabetes medications to look at controlling blood sugar, and they do that because they're basically a different type of hormone that our body makes at the moment we're eating something. And so when we're eating something, our body's going to start to see this rush of sugar in our blood. And GLP-1 agonists like Ozempic work by helping improve that stimulus to help increase insulin secretion. And so it's basically trying to control blood sugars, especially around that meal time, to help keep our blood sugars in check. And part of the way it does that is by slowing gut motility, which then, because of that slowing of gut motility happens, you also feel fuller. And so that's where a lot of the symptoms of decreased appetite come into play, and where the weight loss comes into play. So it's really important for our mito patients to know if they're considering going on to this medication, that the way it works is by decreasing your appetite because of that slowing of the gut. And so a lot of the side effects we can see are like bloating, nausea, and that can be really uncomfortable. And so what we have ended up doing for patients with or without mitochondrial illness is doing a titration approach, like starting at a really low dose and then escalating over many, many weeks. And so if there's a mito patient considering being placed on this medication, it may mean adjusting that schedule even further, maybe going a little slower even to help avoid some of those side effects, because some patients experience it while others don't, and they can de there's definitely a range of symptoms that patients experience. So it's definitely like an individualized approach that needs to be taken.
So in regards to metformin, can it cause issues with B12? I know you mentioned lactic acidosis, but can it create B12 issues?
That's a great question. And actually, I'm not familiar with its association with B12 levels. So I'm going to pass that one up to Dr. McCormick. Do you know?
Thanks for that really good question. Metformin in some individuals can lead to B12 deficiency by affecting the absorption in the gut. So we routinely I mean, we're very cautious with metformin in anyone with mitochondrial diabetes. It's usually like it's rare that we would reach for it, but you know what? Different people require different things. But we monitor B12 and MMA levels, which is another assessment of B12 status if we choose to put someone on metformin. I mean, I would just add, you know, that to what Dr. Guzman mentioned about Ozempic, and I saw one of the questioners said, "Oh my goodness, that there was so much on diabetes management." And there was, you know, when I was started as a fellow, there were like two drugs we had. We had like insulin and metformin. And now we have this whole long list, each of which gives, you know, potential risks and benefits. The other thing I would add to that terrific Ozempic discussion is that we tend not to use Ozempic or related molecules in individuals who do not have weight to lose, right? So folks who have excess or struggling with excess weight gain, then it may be a good fit. But because it can lead to weight gain, if someone's already undernourished, for example, or struggling to keep weight on, that may be less a good choice. And for folks when they lose weight, they may also lose muscle. Ugh. So I saw someone, you know, had a concern about their activity afterwards. So if someone's less active or less able to participate in activities that keep that muscle up, then that can be tricky for those folks too. So there's no perfect solution, is there? Until Dr. Guzman's research gives us one, right?
You mentioned Ozempic. Do you know the connection between that and adrenal insufficiency? I see there's a patient that mentioned that. Is there a connection, or we're still kind of making that connection?
A connection between adrenal insufficiency and.
Ozempic.
So the can I have heard of an indirect connection, which would be Ozempic sometimes really affects ability to drink and eat. So that if you know you're challenging your adrenal glands to help support blood pressure and blood sugar, so like, I mean, it, like a vomiting illness, for example, like that's a connection I have heard before in folks with adrenal insufficiency who take Ozempic, but not a more direct one. But if folks want to definitely send you any other information for us to share with us, that we'd be happy to learn.
Okay, all right. So you mentioned a little bit about nutrition. I'm gonna go back. This is a so this patient asked it. It's a long question. I don't want to try to shorten it and then miss the point. But it says with a mitochondrial diagnosis and established blood sugar issues, it's hard to get a referral from a primary care physician to a nutritionist, let alone one who knows about mitochondrial dysfunction. What is happening to increase nutrition educators who can be patient-centered in their approaches to prevent health crises related to nutrition? Different mito conditions need different sources of food, and just understanding what you're teaching today needs to be more accessible. Do you guys know? We put in the chat for those that are interested in regards to nutrition and some of the items related to nutrition. So please definitely check out the chat. But is there conversation within the community in regards to nutrition and diabetes, and what's going on with that?
Yeah, for sure. I think that's an excellent question. I think when one thinks about diabetes, nutrition is such a central part of the management of that. And at least here in our institution, a lot of our clinics end up being multidisciplinary. we can't know it all, and so we rely on the support of our nutritionists and dietitians who have experience and exposure to mitochondrial illness to help us in those situations. Because you're right, there is very much an individual approach needed when thinking about nutrition in general. And when we add on the complexity of diabetes, then we have to really keep that in mind. And so what we also do at our institution is a multidisciplinary team in the diabetes clinic. And so we're constantly working with several team members to help balance like our patients' separate needs and how they relate to each other. So there are nutritionists and specialists in diabetes clinic themselves too that can help with those types of questions.
How accurate are CGMs and monitoring blood sugar in patients with mitochondrial disease?
That is a very great question. I'm going to say it's one of the questions I'm actually interested in studying. We don't have a lot of data right now in the literature to give a good idea of how accurate they are. And to be honest, it's tricky. Because CGMs, they were designed for high blood sugars. They were designed for patients with diabetes. And our mito patients who have mito diabetes can experience low blood sugars. They're prone to low blood sugars. And it's hard to be able to say, oh, how accurate are our CGMs at a particular range of blood sugar? And so there's a lot of research in other disorders with low blood sugars too that are going into determining how accurate these CGMs are. But in general, as these technologies have continued to advance, there have been incremental improvements to try to get their accuracy better. For example, like the first version of that Dexcom CGM was affected by Tylenol and could give false low readings when a patient takes Tylenol medication just because of the way it's measuring blood sugar. Nowadays, that's not an issue, but there's still much to be studied. Like, for example, I don't know what chronic lactic acidosis that can be seen in our mito patients does to the accuracy of that instrument. And so what we end up recommending is if you're ever in doubt and you're not sure whether that CGM is accurate, check a finger stick blood sugar, because that's the best thing we have right now to tell you what your blood sugar is in the moment.
That's really, really helpful, because a lot of our patients, like you said, do struggle with chronic lactic acidosis. So we really appreciate your research and that you're thinking about these things. There are two questions that kind of relate to each other, so I'm going to try to combine them. A patient asked, could mitodiabetes be exacerbated by the lack of exercise and sedentary lifestyle that mito patients lead due to lack of energy? And then the other question that is kind of similar but a little different is another patient asked why her blood sugar falls down so rapidly, especially after meals, but also when she exercises.
Got it. So those are all excellent questions. And I think to start by addressing the exercise piece, so our muscles play a big part in blood sugar regulation. And that's because our muscles use a lot of sugar to help us move. And so when in mito diabetes, we are using insulin to try to get blood sugar into our bodies, what ends up happening is exercise helps us respond to insulin better. And so a dose of insulin in one moment when you're resting may respond too strong when you're exercising. And so to the point of the patient who was sharing their experience, what we tend to see in our patients with diabetes is that after exercise, for even up to like day or two at a time, your body can be more responsive to insulin than it typically is. And so it's very much like perfect is the enemy of good is what I tell my diabetes patients. Like, we want to keep you safe, but it's really hard for us to replace what our pancreas was doing for our body. And so you're going to see fluctuations throughout the day. An insulin regimen that works one day may not work later, and that's okay. It doesn't necessarily mean your diabetes is getting worse. It just means we need to respond to what your body needs in the moment. And so it's definitely frustrating, but it's why we bring all of this support together with our diabetes team to help understand what your body needs. And then the whole exercise, decreased exercise tolerance in mito is super, super complicated. And it definitely, we definitely think it is, we definitely think it has a relationship to mito diabetes risk. Because again, our muscles play a big role in using blood sugar. And so when you're not able to be as active, there are multiple reasons that can lead to an increased risk for developing diabetes.
Now, I think that's really helpful. And it's helpful to hear too that sometimes your regimens need to change, but it doesn't mean that your diabetes is getting worse, but it just means that things need to change. And so it's good to talk to your doctor about that.
I think I saw, sorry, Stephanie,
yeah.
that in those patients that don't have diabetes and
Thank
their
you.
blood sugars are fluctuating, that is likely, again, we're still understanding more about mitochondrial illness, but because your mitochondria is dysfunctional and blood sugar has to be processed by the mitochondria to make it into energy, if you are having trouble making energy out of sugar, you're probably going to depend on sugar more. And so your sugar is probably going to be used up quicker, which is what we were seeing in those studies of looking at fasting tolerance for patients with mitochondrial illness. And so fluctuations in blood sugar, particularly leading to low blood sugars, I wouldn't be surprised to see in patients with mitochondrial illness, depending on how functional their mitochondria is or not.
That's brilliant. I'm glad that you picked up on that, because I was trying to figure out how to go back and share that. So thank you to the patient that brought that also to our attention, because absolutely, having low blood sugar without diabetes is an issue in our community, and understanding the whys about that are important. There are so many questions in the chat. If we can take a couple more minutes, and then maybe we can follow up with some of these questions later, because all of these questions are really interesting and important. So we really thank everybody for taking the time to write down their questions. I don't want anybody to think that we're skipping over you on purpose. There was a question about elemental formulas and how they affect diabetes and mitochondria.
So elemental formulas are broken down, like simplified nutrients for patients with mitochondrial illness. And when we simplify our nutrition, what our body tends to see, or what our body tends to do, is absorb something quicker. And so what I tend to see in my experience with seeing patients with mito illness is when they're receiving elemental formulas, their blood sugars can fluctuate a lot. And it can be very hard to handle because a lot of the insulins or medications we're using can't keep up with those blood sugar fluctuations, because as quick as they can go up, they can go down. And I guess like an example of that in like a common situation is like orange juice. Like orange juice, chock full of sugar, and that's all it is. It's mostly just sugar. And what ends up happening in patients who we monitor blood sugars closely in is they go up really, really high, but then they don't really last long because it goes through your body's system really quickly, and then it gets processed, and then your blood sugar goes back to normal, or in some situations can even go back to being low. And so from a diabetes and hypoglycemia perspective, that's what can result from using elemental formulas. And then it's up to your care team to help tailor any diabetes management or hypoglycemia management that's being used to make sure those blood sugars stay in a safe range. Dr. McCormick, I don't know if you had anything else to contribute to that.
No, I would just add that, I mean, you brought the important points out that I see a lot of interesting questions about different kinds of nutrition, and there's much to learn in the research space. But, you know, there's a lot of considerations that go into the selection of formula, and you're not on elemental formula for no reason, right? So folks who are on those may have GI absorption issues, may be underweight and struggling with weight, needing to gain weight. So, there may be lots of other issues that will affect the blood sugar response. I think for this group, being aware that the blood sugar response is an important one And working with a nutritionist and a team that considers that as one of the many factors when choosing and adjusting formulas, and then addressing kind of how the blood sugars respond. I should mention, I saw, I think in the questions also, like, you know, what kinds of formulas work better to manage blood sugars depending, you know, I wish we had discretion between all the formulas that exist. Insurance coverage is often a big one, but I find in working with our nutritionists that sometimes they obviously are a font of knowledge. And I agree with the person who was advocating for more access. And we struggle with this with all of our patients with mito disease and others, unfortunately. But, you know, if they tell us, gee, these are the ones that are supported by insurance, these are the ones that address fiber needs, GI tolerance, like, it tends to narrow down the choices anyway. And then we can start with each patient, see what happens to blood sugars, see if we either need to change the formula, add something to it, or change the way the feed is given over a different amount of time, different bolus volumes, etc. Like, those are some of the tricks in the toolbox that we can use.
Thank you both. It's a lot, and the access is such a challenging thing, and I'm sure it's infuriating for patients and clinicians who are trying so hard to do the right thing for their bodies medically, but are limited based on access that way. There was a question in the chat about, is, I'm going to mispronounce this name, but Mgeblumin, I think you mentioned it in your presentation.
Oh, Mgeblumin, yes.
Thank you. Used with Humalog, or does it replace it?
Great question. So at least in the research I was able to read up on, it's a relatively new drug, but its purpose is similar to metformin, in which in certain situations, the hope is it can replace the need for insulin. But if the patient needs insulin and metformin or omeglumin, it can be used in combination. And it's really just to find the right balance of what the body needs at that time. And so in some patients, one can imagine that you can use metformin or omeglumin on its own. But in other patients, you may need insulin on top of that to keep the blood sugars in check.
One patient has autoimmune type 1 diabetes and mito disease, and they were curious if the autoimmunity means that their diabetes is not caused by mito, and if management is any different for type 1 because they have mito.
That's a great question, and it's actually a really good learning point for me, because it's really hard to separate types of diabetes. We, again, in medicine, we're practicing to understand what our bodies are doing, and we unintentionally group things when it's really hard to group things in nature. And so when someone has a diagnosis of type 1 diabetes and mito illness, both of them are definitely going to interact with each other. And I think, you know, since you have, if one is diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, we're going to lean more towards focused type 1 diabetes management. And so we have guidelines in place to help us with insulin needs and how to best meet a patient's blood sugar needs. And it's definitely going to have to be an individual conversation with patients with mito disease as well. And so I think some of the points we hit on during our presentation to keep in mind in a patient with mito illness is they are naturally prone to low blood sugars. So it's important to know to keep a close eye on insulin doses throughout. And then also, a lot of mito symptoms are similar to or exactly the same as diabetes symptoms. So it's really important to keep a very low threshold for checking blood sugars whenever you're feeling different. And then in settings of illness, it's also important to be on top of your blood sugars, because sometimes blood sugars can be really high when you're sick, and sometimes they can be low. And that can be particularly important for our mito patients who are under increased stress and illness and may have other symptoms on top of that. So it's definitely something that should be discussed closely with one's provider to reach the good, like, a good balance.
Okay, I promise this is the last question. And guys, everybody has asked so many questions, and I really, really appreciate your time. And I will take these questions and the ones we haven't answered, I will try to help find some answers for you guys. So if you, for whatever reason, are not, I will send them out to everybody that signed up for this expert series. If for some reason you didn't and somehow you ended up here, just make sure that you email me at sharry, Harry, ajrry@mitoaction.org, and I'll make sure that I get you those answers. But the last question is about eyesight. And have you ever seen eyesight changes like blurriness, et cetera, with new diabetes meds, specifically Jardiance? Jardiance?
Yes, Jardiance. Yes, Jardiance is an SGLT2 inhibitor. So it works by letting that sugar escape the body through the urine. And yes, we've definitely had instances and plenty of experience with patients experiencing vision changes around the time of either diagnosis of diabetes or when we have been able to control their blood sugars better. And that's because our body works by in a balance with the things that are in it. And so when our blood sugars are super high and then get back to normal, there can be a lot of fluid fluctuations in our body, and that includes fluid fluctuations in our eyes. And so when we work to control someone's blood sugar, either at diagnosis or we found a really good medication for them, we've gotten plenty of reports from patients saying, "Oh, my vision has become blurry." And over a couple of days or over a short period of time, that gets better. And it's not necessarily a concern about actual vision health. So yes, we've definitely gotten reports like that.
Well, thank you so much, everyone, for participating today. Thank you so much, Dr. Gutzman and Guzman and Dr. McCormick. My brain is just exploding. It's going 3 million miles an hour right now. I just really appreciate your willingness to take your time and share your expertise and your understanding with our community and how all of this is working and how there's so much changing and so much being learned, and you guys are a part of that. And so we just thank you for all your time and research that you put into to blood sugars, diabetes, mitochondria, how it all works together, and understanding that this is ever changing. And thanks for listening to our patients in this community as we seek to try to seek understanding together. So thank you so much, and we will see everybody here next month to discuss PCDC. Well, thanks again.
Thanks, everyone. This was great.
Thank you. Really fun. Thank you so much.